Okay, I think we're ready to go ahead and go get started again. My name is Shel Lundahl. I'm a Managing Director with Baird's Energy Investment Banking Group, and I'll be moderating the next panel, which is the Private Equity Perspective on Energy Infrastructure. So very glad to have a panel of four here. I'd like each of them to introduce themselves and also talk a little bit about what their company does so you can have a better sense for their individual perspective on some of our discussion topics today. So Adam, we'll start with you.
Thanks, Shel. My name is Adam Bedard. I'm the CEO and founder of ARB Midstream. We started about 2.5 years ago in August 2014. Rig count still high, prices still high. We're backed by a single-family office out of Idaho, a group called Ball Ventures. Mr. Alan Ball is behind that. And we focus on liquids transportation and terminaling. ARB Midstream has a 157,000 barrel a day gathering system in the Niobrara. We acquired that in September. Over the past 2.5 years, we've done a few acquisitions. We acquired SunWest Canada, a Canadian crude oil marketing group in Calgary. We acquired Incor Energy, a Rockies-based marketing group. And we brought on stream a rail terminal in the DJ that provides transportation logistics for frac sand and LPGs, and we've got a development project in the Midland. So we've been fairly active on greenfield development as well as acquisitions. For this audience, I'd say we've looked at about 60 acquisition opportunities over the past 18 months. So we're a fairly active group for being a smaller private equity-backed company based. We're based in Denver, Colorado.
Hi, my name is Peter Augustini. I'm a partner with Energy Spectrum Capital. It's a mid-cap private equity fund based in Dallas that focuses on midstream assets. We were the first private equity fund to focus on midstream. Our Fund One was raised in 1996, so it's been over 20 years. We're on Fund Seven now, which is a $1.2 billion fund. We view ourselves in large part as an incubator for the MLPs. We invest in assets while there's still a lot of risk, still a lot of negative cash flow that MLPs don't tend to like. Once we've generated sufficient cash flow, we usually feel like the natural owner of those assets is an MLP, and we'll sell most of our deals into the MLP market. I think since the founding of Energy Spectrum, we've done 45 or so midstream deals, and the majority of those have ultimately been sold to MLPs or people aspiring to go public at some point as an MLP.
Thanks, Peter. Matt Carbone, I'm the co-founder of the American Infrastructure Funds. We classically are termed, I guess, a lower middle market fund because we only have $1 billion or $2 billion under management, which is crazy for those of us who have been around for 30 years. Our fund was created to invest in asset-intensive businesses that generate income tax efficiently for investors. And so we invest across a wide array of operating businesses and assets that include mostly off the fairway because the midstream and the traditional investments are well-priced in the market with strategics, looking at them all and having efficient costs of capital, et cetera. And we've made about 15 investments, I guess, half in the energy business, half outside the energy business, which I'm happy to talk about later in some of these questions.
I'm Mike Latchin, CEO of Lucid Energy Group, Dallas-based private midstream company. We're traditionally an origination development company. We've been active in the M&A market this past calendar year. We're operating a little north of 3,000 miles of pipe currently with our primary focus on gathering and processing. We do operate some crude oil gathering and terminal facilities in the Midland Basin, and more recently we've been focused primarily in the Delaware Basin following an acquisition that we made at the end of last calendar year from Yates Petroleum. We are a private equity backed with an exclusive commitment from EnCap Flat Rock out of San Antonio. We've got Lucid One and Lucid Two, two different entities that we formed, and combined equity commitments from EnCap Flat Rock are a little north of $850 million, and just active in developing an exclusive pure play Permian midstream company at this point.
Well, thank you all for the introductions there. The first question I'd like to address, I really like your perspective from everyone on this, but just given the steady rebound that we've seen in commodity prices over the last 12 months, how have you seen that impact project activity for the companies, and then deal flow and valuations maybe from the sponsors here? Mike, do you want to lead off with that one?
Sure. I'll take a minute and talk about the two different focus areas for our company: Midland Basin, which is our first iteration of the company, and Delaware Basin, the second. In the Midland Basin first, we saw quite a bit of pullback. Towards the end of 2014, we had 25 rigs running on our dedicated acreage, and that quickly fell to 5 over the course of 60 days after OPEC's announcement on Thanksgiving of 2014. But during the course of that two-year trough, we saw an opportunity where we could be competitive against some of the public MLPs, keeping a disciplined approach on how we were levering the company, but also coming up with some creative capital sources. We were still able to grow 30% year-on-year in the Midland Basin in the midst of, you know, a lower activity level. Quite a few M&A opportunities, but nothing really attractive around the assets. On the flip side, we saw the Delaware Basin constrained quite a bit for growth. During that two-year trough period, there were only two large 200 million a day cryogenic plant announcements that were installed during 2014, 15, and early part of 16. And just in the past 6 months, there have been four of those same kind of announcements in New Mexico, where we're focused in our Delaware Basin position. So there's been a tremendous amount of growth that we've seen recently, and you know, that rebound, I think, is having an impact on M&A expectations. There's also a more competitive environment as we are competing for the gathering and processing opportunities with our upstream customers. It's really boiling down to our level of competitiveness, or a level of success, is going to be related to how fast we can get capital to market from a execution standpoint. So we're trying to be in front of those customers now that we're in development phase post-acquisition, and just trying to be aggressive.
What we're seeing on the investment side is something we've seen as a growing trend over the last 20 years, where the bubble bursting, so to speak, leading to a tremendous amount of M&A activity at reasonable prices hasn't happened, and particularly because the banks have not caused or not allowed for companies to get into too much trouble. They've learned from the last couple of go-rounds that they should extend and try to work with folks. So we haven't seen in the traditional energy side of things a tremendous amount of value opportunities because of the downturn. So and everybody in this room knows that there's always an upturn, and so when you're in the downturn, everybody's always looking backwards at how great it was and want to get paid for what they were, and the downturns are generally short enough in duration that by the time you get to things going up, they're like, well, I want it. It's like the frac sand players. They want to, you know, be valued off of 2018 numbers now, and crazy multiples off of those, as some of the underwriters in the room know. We have a terminaling business, Aero Material Services, that operates 38 terminals that range from frac sand to crude to other in products and substrate materials. And we've been out looking for both customers, which is something that's been interesting, taking over terminals for some of the strategics because they want to reduce costs from an efficiency standpoint, but also acquisition opportunities. And I'd say, you know, the acquisition opportunity market is pretty tough because people, the valuation side is difficult. We focus on, you know, cash flow, and if you're a cash flow buyer in tough times, a lot of those things don't produce. The other thing from, and I guess this gets to one of the other questions that we've seen, is that the emperor's clothes are off a bit, that the midstream assets really do have volume dependence. And so they're not kind of just taking tolls. You know, if people aren't driving by, then, you know, the tolling goes down for a variety of reasons. And with all the changes, so we've been very wary in the traditional midstream space. And frankly, being in California, you know, we wonder why we get things if they come up, as make it as far as we are. So.
Yeah, I'll comment on the deal flow and the valuations from an investor's perspective. The deal flow has been pretty consistent throughout the downturn, but the types of deals have changed fairly significantly. When you first head into a downturn, you see a lot of people trying to negotiate their way out of balance sheet problems, or they've taken on more capital commitments than they can manage themselves. So they're looking for easy partners who are willing to put up some dumb money, and that's not the kind of investing we do. We do look at those deals, but don't have much success with that. As you shift more to the upside of the pendulum, you get more greenfield projects where you might have a producer who's leased 50,000 acres, needs gathering, needs a plant, and they were unwilling to make commitments. They were conserving their capital, not sure what the world was holding probably 2 years ago. Now you're starting to see some of those kind of deals getting done, which are, you know, honestly probably our bread and butter, so it's a little bit better environment for those kind of deals. Although, you know, we did get some deals done in the downturn. I agree with Matt. This has been a different downturn than we saw in 2009 because the capital never went away. The banks hung in there. A lot of private equity is available. The public markets may have been a little softer, but there were still plenty of sources, and you never saw the distressed types of deals that, if you know, those of us who went through 2009 saw back when the financial markets were down and the oil markets was actually coming back during the crisis pretty strongly. You know, that was probably an ideal environment to have dry powder equity dollars to do deals. It hasn't certainly been that way as this downturn has kind of tipped back up.
Yeah, to add a little bit to that, we certainly look at a lot of deals. The deal flow, the quality of the deals has gotten better recently, but we're seeing more MLPs competing in the same market. But yeah, the downturn didn't. It felt like a downturn in some ways. Highly competitive bid-ask spread on acquisitions stayed very high. Certainly, the rig counts just about double. It's been uneven. A lot of growth in rig count in the Permian. Recently, Eagle Ford rig count starting to climb back. Bakken rig count staying pretty low. So it's been an uneven, let's say, recovery. In the midstream space, crude oil and liquids, it's highly competitive. Producers still unwilling or really unwanting to sign any long-term agreements if they could help it. So as a midstream company, we need to be very creative in how we do our deals. Do we take a combination of MVCs and acreage dedications? But we're seeing bottlenecks emerge throughout the value chain. So, you know, the oil field services were on the sort of front end of the knife edge when it started to fall. Well, now they're coming back fairly strong. A lot of concern on the sand side, meaning is there enough sand to supply all the growth the Permian's going to demand? In the DJ Basin, companies moving to enhanced fracs, i.e. a lot more sand demand. So we're seeing that in the DJ again. The bottleneck tends to be permitting right now. So rig count is doubled from the lows, but getting a well permit has gone from 40 days to 75 days. So we're starting to see the impacts of the acceleration out of the downturn. But from a midstream standpoint, a lot of basins still overserved with long-haul pipelines, compressing margins, creating a lot of optionality for producers, good for their netbacks, but certainly makes it difficult from the midstream perspective.
And maybe as a quick follow-up, Peter, you'd mentioned how this downturn has been different, and our keynote today talked about how violent this downturn has been and the six that he's gone through. Has that caused you, maybe Peter and Matt, has that caused you to think differently about risk and maybe in terms of your hurdle rates that you try to target, due diligence? Has that really changed your approach much?
Well, not. I think we still advertise we're seeking private equity returns on capital, you know, 20% IRRs, two times our money. You know, that's what we target. I think probably the appetite for risk has been dialed up a little bit. in the sense that you can't do risk-free 20% deals in the current market with this much capital and this much competition. So what we focus on is, does maybe the first investment, if say I'm building a gathering system, building a plant, may be underwritten at a single-digit type of return, but that footprint gives me lots of follow-on opportunities that will allow me to have an attractive growth project that I can still get my overall private equity targeted rate of return on when I take it out to market.
Yeah, I think we you just have to look at the public MLPs to say that your returns have to be adjusted, because from our standpoint, we're looking to buy yield, grow yield, and use the public markets to continue to or to monetize and create additional value. So when you're underwriting to an exit, historically that was in the 5-7 percent yield standpoint. Now with the average MLP trading, you know, 300 basis points wide of that, it makes a big difference in how you underwrite any given investment. That being said, we are still finding I agree with Peter. Net-net, we haven't changed our underwriting criteria at all. It's a question of how you actually get there from a realistic future standpoint, mm-hmm. right? So that realistically, historically, you could look forward and say, I've got a buyer or the market that can generate a portion of my yield that isn't there today. Okay. And on the build-up side of things, what we're seeing is similar opportunities that we have. It's the larger scale stuff where they're expecting the high prices that don't generate the same yield. So we're just not doing those right now.
Okay. Now, how about in terms of just new capital deployment? And given where we stand today, where we are with commodity prices and where we've been, and you look across the spectrum of energy infrastructure, what do you see as some of the more compelling subsectors or areas within that that are best suited for new investment right now?
Take that one first.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're kind of boring in that respect. We stick to what we know. We do mostly gathering and processing. The good news is, as long as people are out there drilling wells, there's a need for gathering and processing. It tends to pop up in different areas with different attributes necessary. But there's a fairly steady demand for those kind of projects, somewhat correlated to the rig count. We also do terminals and a little bit of storage here and there. So we have broadened our outlook a little bit to pursue other types of assets. We do that by finding a team that has a lot of experience in those areas that we feel comfortable backing and relying on their expertise. And some of these more esoteric to us anyway types of projects like underground storage facilities and that sort of thing.
I see the opportunities in a recovery as would be typical. So you're dealing with some of the services businesses that can ramp up quickly that if you made it through or if you owned one or bought one in the downturn, there's a need for both labor and equipment. We have in our aero business the labor side of the business in the terminal operations, and having that flexible labor force is, you know, great in a recovery. It's awful in a downturn, but it's great in a recovery. Obviously, you know, it all depends on where you are, which basin that you're in, and what you're doing. So if you're in the right place at the right time, you know, you're great. If you're not, you're sitting there holding your PUD in your hand, doing nothing. So we touch a lot of the business. So we have a big waste management business in the East Coast or in Ohio that draws from the Marcellus and the Utica. And, you know, we've seen some flows of drill cutting starting to come up and the rig count going up a little bit there. But that was zero for a very long time. And it's, you know, at today's oil price, you're still not going to see much. Whereas down where all the sand is flowing and everybody's worried about getting there, if you do anything in that area, you're making great money today.
Yeah, I'd add a little bit to that. We're seeing, you know, you talk about subsectors, but sand logistics going into those basins where rig activity is really ramping up and drilling wells are getting longer. LPGs, we're seeing more movement through the inland corridor of the U.S. As liquids volumes expand, you know, one of the structural changes we've seen are exports grow. So having exposure to the export markets is valuable, but additionally, we've seen the rail companies come in with more competitive rail rates, and so I think they're competing against volumes being exported out of the U.S. So we're seeing more LPGs from the Northeast coming into the Rockies and other regions. So those sand and LPGs certainly seem very attractive to us right now.
I think, Peter, you mentioned traditionally gathering and processing is where the private equity has made a bigger splash on taking some risk. That's what we're doing in right now in the Delaware Basin on the New Mexico side, being in front of the producers. Looking back a little bit over the last 3 years, there was a lot of buzz with Mexico's gas reform and a lot of new projects that were advertised and even secured with Energy Transfer, Enterprise, One Oak, making some inroads with CFE. But those were all market-driven projects that were, you know, multi-billion in aggregate dollars and underwritten by a lot of that reform and market opening up. Where I think Kate mentioned it earlier in the MidCon at EnLink, there's going to be some additional infrastructure necessary out of each of the core basins, but trying to aggregate those supply-driven projects and the commitments from the customers are traditionally a little bit longer in the tooth trying to get those negotiations completed. And I think that's where I think private equity is going to be able to step in on the transmission side, similar to what we've done in the gathering and processing sector of the business. There's going to be a point, well, in our outlook in the New Mexico Northern Delaware Basin, where in 2019 we hit some supply constraints. If the activity continues at the pace that it's at today, there's not enough first phase infrastructure getting those residue molecules from plants to the first liquid point. First focus point is going to be the Waha hub in Texas for us. So there's going to be new expansion opportunities that are going to be necessary and driven by the customers and supply side economics rather than the demand side economics that was driving a lot of the new international infrastructure by CFE over the last couple of years.
And so, Mike, maybe to build on that a little bit, since you're living front and center on the activity levels that have been going on in the Permian, and as a question that I often get is that sustainable? We've all been looking at the activity levels. We've been looking at the valuations that have been quite mind-blowing. Do you see that as being sustainable if we maintain a $50 to $60 a barrel world going forward?
I think so, but it's going to be a product of scale. What we see a lot of transactions around our assets today on the upstream side that are small acreage positions that still sell for sub $10,000 an acre. But as soon as there's scale where a large cap buyer can put 3 to 5 rigs to work, you know, the implied valuation can go up by a factor of 4 on a present value basis because of the ability to turn that into cash flow immediately. From a zip code standpoint, being in the core is a necessity, and the economics at $50 oil can drive that, at least in the Delaware Basin. I think that's sustainable. It's going to be a function of can the buyers stay well capitalized and still put those rigs to work, and do we have constraints on the gathering and processing side and ultimately the transmission side that don't impair that ability to put capital to work.
Yeah, I don't disagree with what Mike says. I think there are going to be areas of the Permian that work at $50, I think, very clearly and would continue to see a lot of activity at $50, maybe even lower. There may be some areas that people currently think are going to be working at $50 that won't as more experience dictates what the rock there will produce. I think producers have a optimistic bias. When you dig into the actual results they're getting and compare them to their published expected type curves, you know, maybe they've got one or two wells that have hit that published expected type curve, and the other 6 or 7 they've drilled are science projects that they think are not going to be repeated. But with more data, you find that sometimes the answer is a little less favorable than they believe it originally. But on the other hand, there are areas that do tend to get better over time as the technology improves and the knowledge gets better as well.
Yeah, exactly. Adam, you have any additional thoughts? I know you have a current project going on there in the Permian.
Yeah, no, for a group like us, it's a expensive zip code to get into, a lot of hurdles. There are one reason we've done acquisitions of marketing groups is it establishes a local presence for us, and then we can layer in assets around that. But it's hard for a Denver-based company to enter the West Texas market, so we think it's critical to have a presence down there. But certainly at these multiples, it is challenging.
Matt, there's one area I want to talk about. So AIM has invested across a range of different types of infrastructure assets and been able to successfully take those public as MLPs. Now, given the cycle that we've gone through, given what the MLP world looks like today, how do you think about today, what constitutes a good MLP from your perspective in some of these non-traditional sectors?
I thought you were going to ask how I'm feeling about it. I'm actually 28 years old and should be 150 pounds. It's tough. I mean, the most interesting shift over the last 30 years since I first looked at MLPs in the early 90s, or I guess only 25 years, is the ability for a company to start out small and grow and go public effectively as a small MLP is gone. The investor universe has changed dramatically. The ability for there to be enough liquidity and get appreciated through the MLP structure and grow into something is very difficult, very challenging. You see the K-1s getting in the way of a lot of the individual investors. And you see, the size getting in the institutional. You don't touch an institution until you're $500 million or greater at this point. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the stability and growth in that order argument, where they were assumed to be stable, so everybody was focusing on growth, then stability got brought into question during this last downturn. And so, the public, for a good reason, hasn't had much in the way of new issues lately, because I think there's a wait and see on more certainty on that front. So there's a fundamental distrust between the investors and kind of the stability of the cash flows in the public market. So where it used to be, and it is still for some of the larger players, where it used to be a checking account that you can continue to make withdrawals from and grow, that is not necessarily there.
Now, Peter, wanted to get your perspective on kind of how the financial sponsor universe has changed during this downturn and this kind of recycling back up, and maybe more importantly, what that's going to mean for the next, call it, 10 years going forward. Obviously, it's pretty hard to have a crystal ball and look at that, but would love to get your perspective on how things might look.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the downturn has had a dramatic effect on the sponsors yet. There continues to be a lot of money available for energy private equity. The sponsor universe has been changing, I think, over the years. We style ourselves, like Matt, as lower middle market. We believe the way to create value in the midstream space as a private equity fund is to incubate small projects up to the level where the markets are really competitive. There are other funds. We're about $1.2 billion, which means we can do $100 to $200 million investment sizes is kind of what we're looking for. If you're a $4 or $5 billion fund, and there are a number of these out there now, your investment size has got to be more like $400 or $500 million, and that's a very competitive segment of the market in our view. So we've seen some of the smaller guys get bigger and grow up out of the market where we're going to be seeing them compete for $20, $30, $50 million buy and build type projects. Actually, we still do see some of these big guys doing it, but they have much grander plans, I think, for the investment. One of the strategies, I think Matt touched on this a little bit, that we saw a lot probably 5 or 6 years ago, was just raise a bunch of money, back a management team that probably came out of the C-suite of some MLP, buy up a bunch of assets in the private market and take it public, because there was a an arbitrage between private valuations and public valuations in those days. I think that arbitrage has been gone probably for the last, I'm going to say, 3, 4, 5 years. You just don't see as much private equity doing more of a leveraged buyout, take it public kind of strategy. So you see a lot of people doing organic growth projects. Some of them are just much bigger organic growth projects that require a lot more capital, a lot more risk, probably a lot more backing than the size we focus on.
Okay.
There's also been a whole other set of people smaller than us that have emerged, you know, $100 to $200 million midstream private equity funds that are doing $5 and $10 million deals. So the universe is pretty diverse, and it's pretty competitive out there. You know, we've been at it as long as anybody. We've got a lot of good teams. I think that's kind of how we differentiate ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And maybe to think about changes from the sponsor community from the other perspective, maybe a question more for Adam and Mike. So given that the downturn, does that change at all in terms of what you how you think about your sponsor, what you look for in a sponsor, and have there been certain things that occurred over the last 18 to 24 months that where your sponsor really stepped up and was very supportive of your companies?
I do think sponsorship is the key. Peter and his group have been at the midstream, helm for north of 20 years. That's a very small universe of private equity. Our sponsor is one that has been in the midstream space their entire career, but only investing in the private equity side of it for the last 10 years. But it's an exclusive investment strategy for them. The discipline that they bring as a sponsor in thinking about the business opportunities along with the management team is critical. It was critical to have that kind of sponsorship when we saw the downturn happen in 2014. Thinking about a very conservative leverage scenario, kind of anti-generalist private equity investments was key. It allowed us to weather the storm and even be competitive during that downturn and aggregate new growth. As we looked at potentially coming out of that downturn, the ability to shift from a traditional organic development strategy to an M&A strategy was key for us in capitalizing Lucid 2. And pursuing the acquisition that we did in the Delaware Basin from Yates Petroleum. And for us, our sponsorship with Flat Rock was key because it gave us the scale that we wouldn't be able to get with a lot of the other traditional midstream investment shops, or at least in the private equity space. We were able to form that with a small commitment, but increased to a $600 million equity commitment at the turn of a switch in order to facilitate that acquisition and give us enough equity back in the coffers that we could fund a lot of our growth for the foreseeable future. So I think scale is key. picking the right sponsor that is a disciplined sponsor that knows midstream space can weather the storm, but scale was the key for us.
Yeah. You talk about this is the downturn. To us, this is a downturn.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of them before, so I think that helps. You know, if you rushed in to take advantage of the gold rush environment, you're probably a little more skittish when things go bad.
Yeah. Well, my experience is a little different. This is the first time I've been backed by private equity. When we looked to fund ARB, I didn't have as great an appreciation of the different qualities of the different funding sources. So we ended up with a single family office that for us has been great. They're really a partner of ours in the decisions we make. Kind of like Peter's group, our funding partner allows us to take risk that we couldn't take at the MLP level. In other words, that for us to do a deal at NGL Energy Partners, a lot of it had to be highly contracted back to back. Now, with our current funding partner, we can take more risk. We rely heavily on our quantitative analytics to diagnose the market. And so we'll step into an asset that isn't fully contracted, has construction risk on it, things that we feel we can do well. But our funding partner is new to the space. They don't have deep connections with other energy players, you know, like Energy Capital would, or NCAP for that matter. But on the other hand, we've got fairly strong governance for a new management team, and we can pursue opportunities without bumping into any other portfolio companies. But I'd say, you know, far and away, just having really a partner on the funding side that is able to be with you lockstep through the downturn has been highly valuable for us.
Good.
And
good.
I think that's definitely the case in the IPO market as well. Is what makes a successful company is that it's all about, you know, scale and timing and commitment from the sponsors. So you have to reserve enough capital, have enough capital, have enough patience to see the management team through what they need to do. In the downtimes is when it's hard.
Yeah.
Right. If you're reactionary on where you're going, what you're doing, you're going to get burned most every time. If you're committed to, you know, the quality of a strategy and a thesis, and listen to the management team on what to do, I think you find it. It'll pay off in spades.
Yeah. Great. Well, we do have a couple of minutes left. I did want to poll the audience, see if there are questions for the panel. Pause a minute and see if there are any out in the audience.
Thank you. Since 1973, there's been at least seven major price shocks of probably more than 40% in each instance. In the last 7 years, there's been two major cycles. Do you have any capacity to do forecasting of these price movements? And do you spend any effort in trying to figure this out, what these price movements are all about and how to adjust to it?
I think he's looking at Matt.
No. Yeah, well, I was trying to get.
We're just plumbers on the midstream side.
So. Yeah, I'd say I'll speak about our philosophy with respect to that. We try not to do deals that require high prices to work. You know, and high is a subjective term, and it's one of these things you kind of know it when you see it, but. We wouldn't have been doing back in 2013-14 deals that were marginal on the supply curve and required $100 to work. We wouldn't have wanted to be building pipe to those kinds of assets. So you're always estimating as you're investing, where do I think on the supply curve this upstream project fits? Is it going to be the last place a rig leaves or the first place a rig leaves? And we'll avoid doing what we perceive to be projects in the first place a rig leaves. Sometimes you get that wrong because there's geology involved and things like that. But we don't consider ourselves to be any smarter than most people at trying to predict the price. But we try to invest in projects that are robust across multiple price environments.
Well, and what we do from that standpoint is you look at what the commodity price exposure is, right, inherent in the business in any given scenario. Obviously, there's more one way to go than others at different times, and you try to evaluate that. We're working on something now where we've got three different triggers associated with it where we're going to pay a lot less because the commodity price environment isn't there. And give them more of an earn out on the upside. So we're giving away some of the upside. But in the expected case scenario, we're protecting our downside through a significant hedge. And so we try to look at where the exposure is and then work on it from there. I wish I could predict for me and for everybody in the room where it's going. But.
Yeah, I'm bearish crude prices this year. I just think with the acceleration in rig count, I said, so. Rig additions today, horizontal crude oil rig additions, were at 7.5 rigs a week over the past 8 months. Back in the $100 oil days, it was about 5. So we're accelerating rig count considerably. Storage is fairly full. So I think there's a lot of potential, not necessarily for a shock this year, but for lower for longer. But with the capital starvation and a lot of the deep sea drilling, more expensive plays, I could see potential for the 2019 timeframe for prices to see a lot of strength due to lack of supply. That has, because outside of shale and some of the OPEC producing regions that can come online very quickly, It might take offshore 10 years from permitting to production. So a lot of those projects have been delayed or have been canceled, and I think we're going to see the effects of that show up at some point. But, again, there's a lot of responsive supply, if you want to look at the natural gas markets for some of that, that can really create a range-bound price environment.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this panel. Appreciate everyone's participation here, and please join me in thanking the panelists for their participation today.